more inmate deaths in Florida increase the pressure to clean up the state's correction system. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and now you can subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we will take your calls on the push for prison reform in Florida. Also coming up, how to plan a visit to Cuba. A local travel expert has some tips, and then later sports with Cole Pepper. All of that's ahead. But first, this morning, an internal investigation is underway following the deaths of two inmates at Baker Correctional Institution in Sanderson, Florida, last week. They're just the latest inmate deaths in Florida, which have sparked calls for reform of the state's correctional system. Florida has the third largest prison system in the nation, more than 100,000 inmates, and a $2.1 billion budget. Here this morning, we welcome Wendy Tatter, a local mother and advocate for prison reform. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you very much.
And also in the studio this morning, we have law and safety expert from Action News, Dale Carson. He's returning to talk about a topic he's talked about with us before. And our questions to callers. What are your thoughts about the state's prison system? Do you have an experience you'd like to share? Let us know at 549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or comment on our Facebook page. So Dale, here we are again. In December, the U.S. Justice Department announced it was going to gather evidence for a possible investigation into Florida's prisons. Last month, a grand jury report out of the Charlotte County facility found officers beat an inmate named Matthew Walker to death and covered up the evidence. An internal Department of Corrections investigation is going on now. So what is going on here? Is it that more people are aware of an existing problem, or is the problem getting worse? What do you think?
Well, I think it's getting worse. The facilities remain the same. The populations are higher. And of course, when you have that circumstance, it creates a catalyst for problems. And you need more correction officers. You need fewer inmates. But none of that seems to be happening. The system seems to be expanding exponentially.
What's driving that increase in dramatic population among the inmates?
I think there are more arrests for minor offenses. These minor offenses roll over into more offenses. And the way I see it, for example, there's a traffic stop, you lose your license, you don't have money to pay for your license to be reinstated, you end up in custody twice, three times, it's a felony, then all of a sudden you're in the prison system. Mm-hmm. And we've got to do something about that. I call those RATS, random administrative traffic stops. And that's what's piling up the system underneath. And that keeps people in longer. In addition to which, we're warehousing people for so long now that we've become really one of the largest old folks homes in the entire country.
Mm. And Wendy, this is an issue that is really close to home for you. Now, tell us about your son.
Well, I have to say about 5 years ago, I never would have given a thought to the prison system, which I think many people ignore it totally. And when my son was arrested, he went to prison for 10 years. And in those 10 years, I've seen the abuse, I've seen the crowding, I've seen all these things accumulate into the broken system that we have now. And in my opinion, mandatory minimums are overcrowding our system. First offense, 10 years, second offense, 20 years, third offense, 30 to life. And not only that, but they've changed the time served from 65% of your sentence. Now you have to serve 85%. Hmm. They've also done away with parole. Anyone who was convicted before 1994 is eligible for parole. And anyone after that, there is no such thing as parole in the state of Florida now. So these people are put out on the street immediately, pretty much after being released, and there's a 28% chance that they'll go right back into prison within 3 years.
Now, how old was your son when he went into prison?
He was 20.
20.
20 years old.
Is he still in
He's
prison?
He's still in prison. He's one of the ones who has changed his life with prison. A lot of people get in there and they kind of do drugs. There's a lot of drugs in prison, or they don't take advantage of any opportunity to learn. Well, he took college courses from a place called Ohio State University, has college inmate courses, but the guards threw away his books twice, so he was unable to continue his classes. When it came time to take exams, the officers refused to let him take the exams, so he had to drop those. But he's made other, he's learned Spanish, he's learned sign language, he's teaching yoga, and he's one of the ones who's taking advantage of good things in prison. But
what did you see that made you up in arms asking for change here?
It's just the prisons are in disrepair, ceilings falling in, water leaking everywhere, the microwaves are ancient, food they give must be some contract from government contracts that are just getting the worst food possible. They really don't have amenities at all to keep cleanliness and health issues from occurring. The my son was in Butler, Lake Butler, and he was an orderly in the hospital, and he said there are so many people in prison, in the hospitals. Like you said, the older population is dying in the hospitals there. They're given bad food, they're beaten, they're committing suicide, and these things are happening on a daily basis. It's not getting any better, and people are ignoring the situation.
Did your son see people being beaten before his eyes?
There's no doubt that, yes.
And has that happened to him?
I really would rather not talk about it. I have to say many of the guards are wonderful and helpful, and you know, you have good people and bad people in any situation, and he luckily has been surrounded by good people lately, but there have been times in the past at other facilities that he saw and heard horrible things.
And did you meet with anybody at the Department with Corrections with your concerns?
I did. About a year and a half ago, I had a meeting with the five heads of the DOC, which was shocking because I thought I was going to be in a huge meeting. And as it turned out, it was just myself and them. And we talked for about 2 hours, and the end result was I was preaching to the choir, their hands are tied, all these things have to be changed through laws and changing the laws of mandatory minimums, changing the law about the time served. They said if they thought that 25 years would help everyone, they'd keep everyone in for 25 years, but it is a losing battle. It doesn't work. It needs education.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers on the line wanting to get into the conversation. JJ from Jacksonville. JJ, you are on the air.
Yes. How you doing?
Good morning.
Yeah, I was wanting to share an experience actually I had, I would say locally, in Clay County, Florida. I was actually a culprit in some bogus second degree misdemeanor charge, which I never knew existed. And when I went to cooperate with the officers, as I was writing my statement on a piece of paper identifying myself, I asked the officer a question, and they actually arrested me. He said, "That's enough. I've heard enough. I guess I was wasting his time." So I was actually arrested while filling out a statement in a police report that never got admitted into the evidence of the case and whatnot. I've been calling around to the state attorney's office, and I've kind of gotten the same thing. Like, our hands are tied, or there's nothing we could do. I'm really starting to wonder if it's really a money issue of how people, the mass incarcerations in Florida, really where all the money's going, the fines you have to pay in court fees just for traffic violations, even traffic violations, having a suspended license. I would wonder what percentage of that 100,000, you know, people in prison are subject. And I agree to everything the caller just said. I actually had to spend a night in jail as the officers kind of took their time processing my things. It's kind of like someone sitting in a computer, eating their lunch and waiting while, you know, you kind of sit there wondering what's the next process. If you ask questions, they if they do answer you at all, they answer kind of in an aggressive tone as if you have no right to know any information. It's kind of it's not even a racist type thing. It's kind of an ism thing. It's just like if you are incarcerated, whatever your class is, it's just you have no rights. You lose all your constitutional rights without even having a chance to defend yourself. Of course, unless you have a lot of money and you can afford a lawyer, you know, you can cut, you know, the back doors around these systems. But it really just seems like a money issue. The system is terrible. The conditions are terrible. The food, like you said, is ridiculously terrible. I wouldn't imagine it's like that. You're treated like animals in the state of Florida, at least in Clay County's population.
JJ.
And I can even see how she said about her son trying to get his education, and the officers kind of, you know, throwing books away. That's really not an uncommon practice, like I would say, even in Clay County prisons.
Thank you, JJ, for sharing your experience. Dale Carson. Does that jive with what you've seen with your clients?
It does. And sadly, the solution is in fewer arrests. But of course, everyone believes, at least in the public, that you can arrest your way out of a high crime problem. And even the sheriff's office has admitted that that's not the way. The solution doesn't exist there. The solution apparently exists in raising children that are not violators of the law. And that's really difficult to accomplish because there are so many other factors that impact children's involvement in criminal activity. And so the solution isn't putting more and more people in jail. And as the caller mentioned, and I think it's true, when they get in a circumstance where there are just minor charges, these infractions roll over, snowball into larger infractions. And even though they're not serious crimes, they create an environment where once you're in custody, everything falls apart for you. You lose your apartment, your job, all of those things. And in Jacksonville, there's a recent Times Union article that talks to this issue. There are 4,600 people that were arrested in Jacksonville that never got prosecuted. So they had to hire an attorney, pay bond. They're out of work for a period of time while they're in custody. Those are all bad things, frankly.
We are talking about calls to reform Florida's prison system. That was Dale Carson, law and safety expert for Action News. Also in studio, Wendy Tatter, a local mother and advocate for prison reform. If you have something you'd like to share with us or a question, call 549-2937. And we have some more callers on the line right now. Marie is calling from the South Side. Marie, do you have a question?
No, I just have a comment. It's the economy, and these prisons are privatized. They never used to be, but there's money to be made, and when there's money to be made, you'll find all these problems that, you know, the least amount of money goes in to make the most profit, and that's what's wrong with the prisons. It's a lot of the schools are starting to privatize, and we just have to somehow get away from privatizing people's basic human needs and things like prisons and schools, because we're going to get the least amount for the money that's put into it.
Marie, thank you for your comment.
Money is going to become profit for someone.
Thank you, Marie. And Wendy, you looked like you wanted to respond to that one.
Well, there are 143 prisons in Florida, and 7 of those are private. And I think that is an issue. But I think one of the things about the money, we spend $2.1 billion a year on keeping the inmates in prison. And I think if we started using some of that money toward educating them while they're in there, there are prisons that will not allow an inmate to even study for a GED until they're 3 years from getting out, which makes no sense. We should be having college courses in there. We should be helping them train to do something when they get out so they don't have to go back to a life that they had before.
Dale Carson, do you agree that privatizing prisons is an issue?
Well, right now it's not. Only 2% of the people incarcerated in the entire United States are in private prisons. But it is a trend that we have to worry about because they are not subject to the same rules and regulations that the actual government employees are subject to. And I think that's a big deal. There is a private prison in Georgia. Some of the federal prisoners are kept there out of this jurisdiction, the Middle District of Florida. And of course, you got to travel into Georgia in order to meet with your prisoners or your clients. And it is rather difficult. And they don't seem to be controlled as much as the government corrections facility people are, and I think that's a bad thing.
There is one thing, though. I have talked to many of the inmates when I visit my son, and it's interesting that the inmates think that the private prisons are the ones they want to be in because their guards are less abusive and they get better food. That's really what I hear, and I don't know anything about that, but it's an interesting fact.
Now, Governor Rick Scott recently has shown he's paying attention to this issue. He's bringing an independent auditor to look into the department and calling for more emphasis on mental health issues. Wendy, is this enough?
Governor Scott has thwarted Senator Evers' efforts to get an totally independent committee of seven people together to go and make surprise visits to prisons. Governor Scott has appointed three people from within the DOC to do the same thing, which to me does nothing.
Now it looks like there will be an independent audit, though, of Florida prisons. We'll see what comes of that.
I'd like to see if it's really independent.
Sure. And next, we have Yolanda. Yolanda is calling from Springfield. Yolanda, you have an experience you'd like to share.
Hi. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning. Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, yes. I was a corrections officer. I'm retired for 25 years. And first thing I'd like to say, I'd agree with Dale that the private prison system is not an issue right now, but it will be one day. And I wanted to really speak on having worked in the jail system and prison system, and I still currently do audit prisons and jails, that there has to be a swing in the public opinion, because the public does not want prisoners to have good food. Prisoners, you know, doesn't want them to have education. And I think it stems from a lack of information and lack of knowledge. If the public at large knew the benefits of an education, or why there's air conditioning or food, or why there are certain standards that have to be maintained for people who are incarcerated, then there would be a better understanding. Corrections is the only industry that's really not seen. You see fire, you see police, and the only thing you see about corrections is when you hear something bad, or you see something from the TV. And there are a lot of good people who work in the prison and the jail system, but there's a lot that's wrong, and it takes a lot of money to fund corrections, and it doesn't work. It's obsolete, and it doesn't work. It's not good for society or the individuals that are incarcerated, and that's pretty much all.
Thank you. Thanks, Yolanda. So you have two different issues she brings up here, maybe a lack of sympathy or a lack of knowledge of the public of these issues, and then funding. Those are two things that are being fought here. So is it really just all a matter of funding,
We used to see prisons and incarceration as rehabilitative, and we no longer do that. We really see it as punitive.
Punishment.
You do something wrong, you should be punished. And it's interesting. We think of all this as novel, but Genghis Khan, back in the 1200s, when he took over China, what they did was, if they had someone who committed a crime, they put a sign out in front of his house that said, "You committed this crime. This guy is guilty of robbery, rape, murder, whatever it was." And then that individual was forced to work for the government, explaining to them how these people would steal or do the things that they did wrong. So we really haven't advanced as far as we think we have. And we need to focus more energy, more effort on sorting out the problems that bring about this criminal conduct. Someone mentioned the economy. I think it's true. When the economy goes in a dive, I think more people commit crimes because they're trying to support their families. Now, I'm not saying that we should excuse criminal conduct. We shouldn't. We should all live in a world where we're free from that sort of criminal conduct, or worry that you're going to be attacked or burgled or robbed or your car stolen, those kind of things. But on the other hand, we need to learn to help one another so that these people don't live in such disparity of wealth.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of focus on punishment versus rehabilitation, it seems these calls for reform are coming at a time that may be part of a national shift. I mean, you have President Obama commuting sentences of nonviolent inmates. You have the U.S. Supreme Court about to hear a case challenging Florida's execution methods. So it's maybe a reexamining of our punishment in general.
I have a comment to make about President Obama. I love that he wants to excuse nonviolent offenders, but in my opinion, you need to also look at the violent offenders and educate them. And, you know, there are circumstances in every case, and judges not being able to decide on the sentencing method or the sentencing time is a huge issue. The mandatory minimum should be looked at for everyone, not just nonviolent offenders.
Just from my perspective in regard to that, minimum mandatories restrict the judge's ability for her to sentence based on someone's personal history. On the other hand, violent offenders are dangerous to all of us. Mm-hmm. And certainly those people need to be kept out of the general population. But so many of the offenders are nonviolent. And it's those people that really clog up the system and put us in a circumstance where we have too many people that corrections officers are trying to deal with.
And we have more callers on the line. Jamal is calling from Jacksonville. Jamal, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a little excited. Give me a minute. I wanted to speak to, I agree with what Mr. Carson said about raising children who don't commit crimes. That can be most important deterrent from keeping people out of the prison system is parents actually parenting and raising their children properly to keep them out of the penitentiary and the prison system. The other thing I would like to address is the mother who has her son incarcerated. I noticed that she mentioned about the abuses that her, or, you know, the things that her son went through, but she failed to mention what her son was arrested in the prison for. So, you know, let us know the whole story before we jump on the sob story side. And also, I understand no one needs to be abused when they're in prison, but it's prison. You're there because you committed a crime, and it's punishment to deter you to keep from coming back. I understand the conditions need to be livable and clean so that infections and diseases are kept down and people are fed the proper food to maintain nutrition and all of that. But you committed a crime. And you, in our country, you get punished by being sent to prison for that. And as far as the food is concerned, this, I'm not saying this for all prisons or all correctional facilities, but I did 20 years in the Navy and I worked in the kitchen. I saw the boxes that our food came in. I saw the boxes that our food came in that said it was approved for prison industry. So if we can eat it, they can eat it too. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Thank you, Jamal. And Wendy, is that something you hear a lot, that it's prison, it should be a punishment?
No, I totally agree. They are there to be punished. They're not there because they're nice guys. And my son committed a terrible crime. He did a home invasion. He deserves to be in prison. I do not dispute that at all. I do dispute the fact that there is incredible abuse that no one knows about. It happens every day. And in most cases, the guards are really reasonable and nice. And if you do what they say and do what you're supposed to do, which is be a reasonable person and not get in fights, you get through prison all right. But there are many, many cases where you can't. One thing they do is they put violent offenders who get 30, 40, 50 years in with people who have 5 years. And those violent offenders who have that much time don't care what happens. They don't care. And they will hurt people. And they will... Do you agree with that?
No, I do agree with that. But one of the problems, and Jamal spoke to this, we need to have something for young folks to do, employment, something for them to spend their lives that it's pleasurable for them to do, that's not just flipping burgers somewhere.
Exactly.
And we are running into a period with AI, which is artificial intelligence, where it won't be long before the back-breaking labor jobs that many people can do are no longer available. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to, as a society, consider what on earth we do to provide for something for people to do in order to survive in this economy and in our country.
Going to the phones, we have Rodney calling from Jacksonville. Rodney, you are on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and I appreciate you discussing this issue. I did 8.5 years in the Department of Corrections, which I deserved every day. My comment is on the rehabilitative issues that have come up. Prison right now is a trash can for society. In 1994, when the state of Florida passed the criminal punishment code, the language read that rehabilitation only occur if it was convenient and affordable. Well, what we're seeing now is not rehabilitating and not educating prisoners is not affordable. You're creating a revolving door, increased recidivism rates, and people are coming out of prison, if they do not rehabilitate themselves, worse than when they went in. And until that law is changed, as we pointed out earlier, hands are tied. So it needs to go back to the criminal punishment code and look at the cost of not rehabilitating. Thank you.
Rodney, thanks for your comment. Dale Carson, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. But again, it's a cost issue. And we're warehousing so many people, there's no excess or reserve to address those issues. And the problem is we're overloading the system with people who don't need to actually be in custody. They've committed administrative crimes, and I don't know whether you're aware of it or not, Wendy, mm-hmm. but every year there are more and more and more crimes on the books as though if we legislate a rule, that somehow is going to make the world a better place, right. Which is far from the truth.
And if you have thoughts about Florida's prison system, call us at 549-2937 to join the conversation. We have David calling from the South Side. David, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to mention, you know, drugs play a big part in many, many incarcerations. I'll give you, I'm a 49-year-old white man. I'm from Southern California. Many of the kids I played Little League with or went to Boy Scouts with or, you know, they were good guys when they were kids. We, including myself, all got involved in drugs. And, you know, myself and a couple others were smart enough to realize that, hey, this isn't the way to go. And we straightened our lives out without incarceration or the penal system. But I have several friends that went through the penal system in and out, 2-3 year convictions. And it took until their mid-40s, where they've recently got out, that they've realized for them to overcome their addictions. And when you look at the amount of money that's being spent to house a guy for a drug conviction in a state penitentiary, you know, I hear it's anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000. You give that man an opportunity to go to a rehabilitation program, a rehab, and offer him some kind of minor education. When you look at a 3-year drug conviction, that's $75,000. That buys rehabilitation. That buys some kind of trade or skills training. And now when we're done with that guy, we have a paying, tax-paying individual that's going to contribute to our society for the next 30 years. And that's where the big problem in the prison systems is. We need prisons to take care of the violent offenders, the rapes, the robberies, the heinous stuff. But if you look at all the people that are convicted and ask them, what drove you to commit this crime? I bet you 80% of the cases, they're going to tell you, I'm addicted. I have some kind of addiction that's got my mind upset and disturbed to even have me to the point where I'm committing this crime. And, you know, that needs to be in the discussion right now.
Thank you. David.
That's all I want to say.
Thanks for your call. And Wendy, is that an issue that you think needs to be addressed, people having drug addictions?
I agree. I think a lot of the people who are incarcerated, they committed their crime because of drugs, my son included. He was a terrible pill addict and wasn't allowed to use that in his defense. I have a friend who's a judge in Maryland who said that if he had been arrested in Maryland, he would have been in jail for a 3-year sentence with an in-prison drug treatment program. But he was arrested in Flagler County, where he was not allowed to even bring into the courtroom the fact that he was on drugs when he committed a crime.
Is there a treatment for people who are addicted in prison?
Actually, the system is set up to take those people and keep them out of the criminal justice mm-hmm. system. There's drug court. There are any number of programs that we as defense attorneys use to put people in treatment so that they don't receive these maximum penalties that they can if they go to court. Mm-hmm. But those systems, you have to be smart about those systems. You have to know that they exist. You have to have an attorney, someone who will point you in that mm-hmm. direction. Many of these folks don't have anything. They don't have any money. They can't hire private counsel. And the public defender's office, of course, is pretty well overwhelmed right. with providing free legal help to the individuals who can't afford it.
Sure.
He's right.
Now, Wendy, you are involved with a group called the Initiative for Compassion out of St. Augustine. And what does that group do?
They try to find causes that are in need of help, and they try to educate people about what's going on. And the cause that they started reading a book together called The New Jim Crow, which is a very interesting book about abuse in prisons. And while they were reading that, they heard me speak somewhere, and they invited me to come speak at their group. And since then, they've been working on the issues of prison reform, like mandatory minimums, reinstating felons' rights after they're let out of jail, which is a really big deal, too. We need to start thinking about that. And the abuse. And so they're having a meeting on Monday the 10th at 5:30 in St. Augustine at St. Cyprian's Church. If anyone would like to join, they would love to have more people come and be educated about what's going on with the prison system.
Sure. And you hear this so much, Dale Carson, about once you've served your sentence, you haven't really served your entire sentence, now trying to get a job, and once you're released, trying to move on with your life.
Well, you know, it's not actually the prison system that starts that. It's your actual arrest. because the way the computer systems work today, you can no longer seal and expunge. I mean, you can technically do those things, but they don't take you out of the system. So if you've been arrested even for a false crime, mm-hmm. someone's lied about you and you're arrested, that arrest report goes to the federal government where your fingerprints are retained, and it's available for investigators and for pretty much anybody in the country to see that you've been arrested for an offense. And unfortunately, people who see that you've been arrested think that you've been convicted. Now, they're mm-hmm. two different things, rather obviously, but it has a tremendous impact. And one of the things, I wrote a book several years ago with Wes Denham that's called Arrest Proof Yourself. And in that book, I discuss quite clearly that police officers, and many police officers will disagree to this, and I don't mean to impugn the character of most police officers, but the way the system works is you are promoted from street officer to detective based on the number of arrests that you make. So you have all these arrests for people, as I just mentioned earlier, 4,600 last year that were arrested and not prosecuted. All those people have an arrest record, and that affects their ability to get employment. Once you're a convicted felon, when you do go through the system, and if you are convicted, you can't vote, you can't keep a firearm, and there are other reasons for not keeping a firearm as well if you're charged with domestic violence. And today, instead of working out problems, what happens is police officers go into a situation, take, for example, a minor domestic where two people are fighting. When they show up, they are protected. Police officers are protected from ever being sued for making an arrest in this circumstance, and that's by the intent of the legislature. You go in, two people are fighting, you can arrest both people, but you're clearly going to arrest one person. That person is now charged with domestic violence. When we hear that term in the open, we go, domestic violence? Oh my God, this is horrible. Mm-hmm. So if you have you've slapped someone, just you made some horrible comment and a lady slaps you, she's going to go to jail for slapping you, when 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. Now, it may have protected, certainly has protected many people from being killed or injured in connection with domestic violence. My point merely is that we arrest everybody for everything now instead of letting things kind of slip by.
Exactly. And that follows you. That
it does. Absolutely.
Well, another thing on an employment application now, they all say, have you ever been arrested? And you know, everybody checks everyone's background immediately. Years ago, you could get a job. Now, if you check that box, you can't get an apartment in most places. You can't get a job in most places. You can't get licenses, even to be a hairdresser. You cannot get a hairdresser's license if you are convicted of a felony. I mean, there's many licenses that are lost to you forever.
Sure.
And it's a terrible thing because now they're going to have to work at McDonald's and make minimum wage instead of start their own business. It's pitiful.
We do have one more call. Mitch is on the line calling from Ortega. Mitch.
Thank you very much.
And what is your, what's your question? Mitch? All right. Well, thank you for calling. I'm sorry we didn't get to it. And that is all the time we have. Thank you both so much for joining us. Wendy Tatter is a local mother and advocate for prison reform. Dale Carson is law and safety expert from Action News and a justice analyst and former law enforcement officer. Much more still ahead on today's show. Later in the hour, we'll look at all this weekend's sports with Cole Pepper. But up next, if you're thinking about traveling to Cuba, we've got tips from an expert. That's next on First Coast Connect.
Jacksonville has a new mayor and a new sheriff. How will they tackle the violent crime rate on the First Coast? On Thursday, August 13, you can be part of the studio audience as WJCT's First Coast Forum looks at gun violence in a live, hour-long broadcast at 8 p.m. If you would like to join us in the studio for the discussion, please go to wjct.org/events/violent crime.
Relax Radio is the great American songbook, oldies and light jazz.
The thing that's cool for me is that I it feels like it's the music of my life.
Relax Radio is the station you can listen to all day on your HD radio. Make a $120 gift to WJCT and you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. The normalization of relations with Cuba has meant a surge in interest in travel to the island, especially from people here in Florida who are so close by. Margie Jordan, who owns Jordan Executive Travel Service here in Jacksonville, says there are some important travel tips to keep in mind if you're planning a visit to Havana. She joins us now in studio. Welcome, Margie.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what, first of all, what is the easiest way to get to Cuba? Do we have a couple of options here if we want to go?
Well, you have really one option. One really good option is to work with a travel agent or a tour operator. We still can't go over for leisure vacations just right now. You can't go over and just lay around on the beach. So you really need someone to create an itinerary that is legal, ultimately, for you to go to Cuba.
How do we know if our itinerary is legal?
Well, the best thing is, again, to work with someone who is providing that service for you. A travel agent or a tour operator can do that. We have programs that are already set up. We have itineraries that you can choose from. And it's really a full-time schedule of activities while you're there, with meeting with the Cuban people and getting familiar with the culture. Not a lot of beach time, so.
Okay. Well, we actually have a call on the line already about Cuba. So actually, Stephen is calling from Miami.
Okay.
And Stephen from Miami, you are on the air. Stephen?
Hi, good morning. I have a really quick question. As some of your listeners may know, the island has sort of a peculiar currency issue where it's one island but two currencies.
Okay.
They have what's called the Cuban peso and the Cuban convertible peso. And so should I travel to Cuba and I run out of U.S. dollars, which still reigns supreme as the island sort of currency in the sense of actually working day to day for tourists, what kind of currency should I use on the actual island?
Well, good question, Stephen. Thanks for your call. Margie, what currency should we bring?
Well, there are two currencies there. And really, when you get to the airport, you want to exchange that currency for the Cuban convertible peso rather than just the Cuban peso. And it is actually more valuable. It's 25 times more valuable than the Cuban peso. So it's something you kind of want to know. But when you're in the touristy areas and you're traveling on the trips that we create, you're going to need that convertible peso. You're not going to want to travel with U.S. dollars. It's going to be tough to convert those. No traveler's checks. No checks, not even credit cards. Our U.S. credit cards eventually will be accepted there, but right now it's not.
Okay, so you got to do that conversion once you get to the island.
Yes, yes.
All right. And when you're planning your trip, what kind of documents do people need to get together?
Well, you'll have to have a visa. And if you're working, again, with a travel agent or a tour operator, then we do that service for you, make sure that that visa is obtained. You also have to have some form of travel medical insurance. And that can be purchased as well with your flight. Even with the flights nowadays, they're charter flights, so you can't go on a website, even a Cuban website, and book a flight. Your transaction would be denied. So you have to work with a third party.
Okay. So now that the U.S. Embassy is opening in Cuba, are there things available to me if I get in trouble in Cuba that maybe weren't there before?
Well, we definitely recommend that you go to the embassy if you do have some problems. But for the most part, traveling Cuba is fairly safe, and I don't suspect that you'd have much problem at all. As long as you were abiding by the guidelines, you should be great.
And following that itinerary that my travel agent has given me.
Yes.
So are there places, though, that if I stray from that path that I want to make sure to avoid on the island?
Well, you actually actually won't stray from the path. And I'll tell you why. It's because it's usually done in a group travel. So there's very few times that you'll be wandering off by yourself. Now, when you get back from that full day of activity, you might have some free time in the evening to go explore some restaurants or that sort of thing. Perfectly safe to do. You won't have any issues. But in terms of during the day, in terms of wandering off, that's probably not going to happen on those organized tours.
So have you had people asking you about tours to Cuba now that we've been talking about the diplomatic relations being restored with Cuba?
Lots of interest in Cuba. There's a number of people who are looking to travel over now and just trying to figure out the best way to do that. I still think there's a little bit of clarity that needs to happen because we can't do it for leisure travel so much. And I think there's a lot of people with visions around those beautiful beaches and that sort of thing. It's just not available to us that yet. While the door has opened a little, it's really just a little bit.
So if it's not leisure travel that we're talking about, what do we call it? What do we?
It's people-to-people travel. It's what it's called. And when Americans are going over, really, again, that's that full-time schedule of activities while you're there, and you're really interacting with the culture. It's a great way to see Cuba and understand its history. You spend time maybe with some of the local small businesses, the farmers, the performing arts, and you just get to know them. You get to spend time with them and understand what their lifestyle is about, and you get to experience great Cuban food, and you have a wonderful time.
What is it that you think draws people from Florida to Cuba? What is the attraction there?
I think it's still that forbidden island. You know, when your parents told you when you're little, don't touch something, and you always wanted to touch it. Same kind of deal. I think it's just a place we've not been able to go, and we're just curious about what Cuban life is. We've seen the photos, the old cars. We want to explore that.
Can you have a Cuban cigar while you're there?
You can. And actually, with some of the new regulations, you can bring some back. You can bring up to $400 in goods back, and only $100 of that can be in alcohol or tobacco products from Cuba.
Okay, so you can bring some back for your friends,
A little bit back, yeah.
Okay. So on your tours, do you have beaches on the itinerary at all?
You don't spend a lot of time on the beaches at all. You might actually get there, take a quick look, or if we have a hotel that's situated close to a beach, you might get to see that a little bit. Okay. But you won't get to spend long days lounging around in the sun with a cocktail.
So what does a typical tour look like?
It could be anywhere from 7 to 9 days, and it could be longer as well. The cost usually starts at about $2,500 on up to about $4,000, depends on how long you stay. And there's a schedule of activities. It could start with the first day with you getting oriented into the city a little bit, and you'll spend some time out in the country areas meeting some of the farmers. Mm-hmm. You might get to spend some time with some performing artists. The schedule changes. The itineraries change. Just depends on what's available at the time you're looking to go.
When's the best time to go?
Really, the dry season is like November through April, so it's a little rainy outside of that, but you know, it's kind of like the Florida rain. It pours really, really hard, and then it's gone.
Right, 5 minutes later,
yes,
the weather changes.
It's shiny. It's all great.
All right. Well, Margie Jordan, that is Margie Jordan, who owns Jordan Executive Travel Services here in Jacksonville, with some travel tips if you're interested in going to Cuba. Margie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, Culpepper joins us with a look at this week's sports news. We'll be back in a moment.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
On the next Fresh Air, Buzz Bissinger revisits Friday Night Lights, his best-selling book about a Texas town's obsession with high school football, which became a movie and a TV series. There's a new 25th anniversary edition. And he talks about his obsession with leather, his shopping addiction to tight-fitting designer clothes, and going into rehab for treatment. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT is proud to be your number one preset for your evening commute. But if you only turn on 89.9 when you're driving, here's what you're missing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for
listening. This is The World.
Spend your afternoons with WJCT for unique conversations about the topics of the day. Join us weekdays from 2 to 6 for The Takeaway, The World, and All Things Considered. It's the smart way to spend your afternoon.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo sitting in for Melissa Ross. And finally this hour, the Jaguars training camp enters week two.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper's here now with a look at This Week in Sports. Hi, Cole.
Hi, Jessica. Today is day four of Jaguars camp. The team began practicing on Friday. Yesterday, they worked in shoulder pads for the first time. They won't be in full pads until Wednesday. Tonight at 6, a little change-up. The team will hold its training camp practice at Mandarin High School. Second straight year that the Jaguars have taken their training camp practice on the road. Last year, it was at Bartram Trail High School. It's free to attend, but you must register at Jaguars.com. This will be a new experience for the rookies and new faces like free agent center Stefan Wisniewski.
You know, expecting some fans to come out and try to get it like a game atmosphere, you know, try to get fired up and be kind of like playing high school football again. I'm excited. It's been a while.
For those who were here last year with the team, they'll know what to expect. Running back Toby Gerhart, looking forward to the experience again.
It's fun to interact, you know, with different people, go out there and connect with the following, as Gus would say, and go out there and do what we do and have a good practice.
If it was anything like last year's practice, there'll be a lot of energy around when you have folks. It's a real community feel. They had the entire kind of Bartram community last year out there, and I'm sure Mandarin will be turning out in big numbers this year as well. But there is still practice to be done and a training camp to be handled. And while the two biggest questions of the preseason are the progression of quarterback Blake Bortles and the improvement of the offensive line, Gus Bradley has spent most of the early part of camp focused on the other aspect of the offense.
What I really like is I think you can tell some of the drill work we have implemented, both in OTAs and now, about the emphasis on the run. We got to find a way to run the ball. If we run the ball, it will protect the quarterback, and it will also minimize turnovers. So just by, you know, running the ball, we can accomplish a couple things that are really important to us.
You can make all kinds of judgments about what the offense looks like so far, but until they start putting the pads on, until they really start tackling, it's all just kind of, you know, projection. So we'll see how it starts developing starting Wednesday. Saturday, by the way, they'll have their annual scrimmage inside Everbank Field. And then again next week, that ends with the preseason opener against the Steelers. That is a week from Friday at Everbank Field.
And can people see the scrimmage on Saturday?
Yeah, again, that is available and open to the public. In some past years, that's been a season ticket owner only event. This is open to the public again. So usually a good crowd, something in the 10 to 15,000 range turns out to watch guys practice football.
Great. So from Jags to Sharks.
Yeah, they're in the playoffs, but they'll have to go on the road to open the postseason after a 64-50 loss to the hated Orlando Predators. You have to say that. That assured the Sharks would make a playoff trip return in Orlando when the playoffs begin in 2 weeks.
All right. And what's up with the Armada, Cole?
Really a gut punch of a draw at home on Friday night for the Armada. They were leading 3-1 with 18 minutes of regulation time remaining. Then they gave up a fluke goal. Mm-hmm. Then a second yellow card on defender Sean Nicklaw put Jacksonville at a man disadvantage for the rest of the match. That saw Minnesota score the equalizer, 3-3 the final. Could have been a loss if not for an acrobatic lunging save by Miguel Gallardo, the Armada goalkeeper, that wound up on SportsCenter's top 10 for the evening. So some pub there. The Armada on the road Saturday at Tampa Bay against the Rowdies, and back home a week from Wednesday to face the Carolina Railhawks.
All right, and the Suns
beat Pensacola 5-4 to begin a quick 5-game homestand at the baseball grounds. So a quick chance to get out there and see the Suns play before the baseball grounds is converted back to Community First Park for soccer a week from Wednesday.
All right. Thanks, Cole.
Thank you.
Follow Cole Pepper on Twitter, @ Cole Pepper. And that is our program. Thank you to all of our guests and all of our callers. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by Pyotr Chepchik. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and make sure to subscribe to our daily podcasts on iTunes or Stitcher. Next, on The Diane Rehm Show, the Koch brothers just held their annual meeting over the weekend with hundreds of big donors in Southern California. Diane looks at the brothers' role in the 2016 presidential race and the latest on how the candidates are raising campaign cash. That's coming up next. I'm Jessica Palumbo. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here at 9 tomorrow morning. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.